Welcome to Cynicism.
First up in our snowy double feature, we have a couple of CGI good boys in The Call of the Wild.
How do you feel about an adventure?
And then we escape from the elements in The Lodge.
How would you feel about going to the mountains for Christmas?
Hello and welcome to Cynicism. I am Brian.
And I am Nick.
And we're here to talk to you about a couple of movies that we saw this week.
Yeah, we saw a few.
Yeah.
We saw some very snowy movies. That's the middle of the winter.
We saw some scary movie.
Yeah.
And we saw some
doggy movie.
Lots of doggies in this one.
Movie. Yeah.
Yeah, we saw The Call of the Wild.
Starring Harrison Ford.
And a bunch of CGI dogs.
Yep.
As well as The Lodge.
Starring Riley Keough.
Yes.
But we wanted to, you know, it's the middle of the winter. Maybe you're not going out and seeing CGI dogs as much.
But you're definitely seeing snow everywhere.
Yeah. And maybe you just want to watch some good snowy movies from the confines of your home.
You don't want to experience it, you just want to see it.
Yeah, look outside, you see snow. Look up at your TV, you see snow.
But you're warm and you're under a blanket. And that's the best kind of snow.
Yeah, sure. That's a good snow. So before we dive into our two big snow releases that are in theaters, me and Brian thought we would just name a couple movies you can watch on streaming right now that are also snowy movies.
Well, I don't know if mine are on streaming, but I'm going to talk about them.
I'm sure you can find them somewhere.
You bet you can rent them.
So what was your first movie you wanted to mention, Brian?
Okay, so, I'm going to start with a movie that's all about the snow. And it's safe for the children. It's called Ice Age. Came out in 2002. Starring Ray Romano, John Leguizamo, and Dennis Leary as three men and a baby. But this is for kids. Ice Age takes place in the prehistoric era where the Earth has frozen over. Ray Romano plays a woolly mammoth. Dennis Leary plays a saber-toothed tiger. And John Leguizamo plays a disgusting, mossy sloth.
Do we know who plays
the scrat?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
I wonder if that's even like a person.
I feel like it is a person, and they're probably just like, yeah, just you don't have to put my name on the movie. I played a rat squirrel.
Robert De Niro is Scrat.
Yeah, Scrat is probably the best part of Ice Age for me because it's just constantly just slapstick humor, just getting beat up, and feels a little bit Looney Tunes at times.
Yeah, they're just like nice, fun little short films of the little guy just trying to make it by.
Yeah, just trying to eat that nut, just trying to get his nut, trying to hide it in the snow.
Trying to get its nut has different like, connotations, Brian.
But in a kid's movie, it just means a regular nut. He takes this nut everywhere. And he accidentally like breaks off like part of a landmass by like shoving it in the snow. There's nothing going right for Scrat, but these other three animals that are taking care of I'm going to say it's like a caveman baby.
Yeah, it's Ice
early
Age.
Man.
It's Ice Age.
And you know, this early man baby is wearing a jacket and I don't know. I guess they're just trying to get it back to where it came from.
I think that's the basic premise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They meet a lot of things along the way. This movie is completely covered in ice and snow. And if you're trying to watch a snow movie with your kids, I bet you could watch this one.
Yeah. That's a good pick. I remember seeing that in theaters when it came out.
Did you like it?
I think I was okay on it. I don't know that I ever saw any of the sequels. I know they eventually got to like non-prehistoric times.
They definitely put some dinos in there later.
Yeah, so they were around for a bit. Mm-hmm. So kudos to all those guys, the sloth and everybody, for sticking around.
Way to go, sloth.
Yeah, good job, man. Well, my snowy pick is something that's kind of a classic, and it's a movie that feels an appropriate recommendation this week, because it's actually watched in one of the movies that we're going to be talking about, and that's John Carpenter's The Thing. This is a classic 1980s sci-fi horror film. You can currently stream it on Hulu. And this actually might be one of my like five or ten favorite horror movies of all time. And it stars Kurt Russell and a shape-shifting alien from outer space that sort of mutates and absolves matter and has some of the most disgusting visual effects I've seen in my entire life.
Lots of wiggling, bloody, goopy things in the movie.
Yeah, and some of just the best scares you've ever seen. But in terms, too, of just the way the snow plays a role in this, obviously they're at Antarctica, and you get that claustrophobia from them not really having anywhere to go because of the elements. And it's part of what makes this such like a great sort of capsule horror film. And yeah, I mean, what can you really say about The Thing that hasn't been said before? It's an all-time classic. It's one of those ones that if you haven't seen at this point, it holds up remarkably well. It's not something that feels terribly dated. Almost everything in it still works. If anything, I think the practical effects in the movie look more realistic than a lot of the visual effects we see now in horror movies. It's just incredible. It's one of the creepiest fucking movies you can possibly watch.
It's definitely got a kind of like an ambiguous ending.
Yeah, it's got, I would say for me, just plain downbeat ending. It is, it's a great, great, just fuck you, the world sucks ending.
Well, keeping it on the snowy horror train, I have the pick of The Shining, starring Jack Nicholson as, you know, a guy who's taking care of an inn with his family in snow country. It's the time of the year where everything gets too snowy, so people just can't stay there. You know, he's got some history that he's not taking care of. He obviously has some mental illness that he's not addressing. And as the movie goes on, his psyche just takes a turn for the worst, and also just kind of goes and makes his family have a really bad time.
It's not the most fun getaway, right, in the world.
Like, you think having a whole like ski chalet to yourself would be wonderful, but if you're sharing it with some ghosts,
not the best. not the best inmates to hang out with.
So it's, you know, it's a wonderful Stanley Kubrick film. Definitely like the winter weather, it plays an impact, because like, hey, maybe you can just get away, but no, you can't, because the snow is kind of like got you stuck there.
Yeah, and it's similar in a lot of ways to the Thing, in that it has that presence of just the claustrophobia of being condensed to one space, not being able to leave, looking at the same elements day in and day out, just that like freezing tundra landscape around you. And yeah, it has, again, similar to The Thing, just some of the most iconic imagery you've seen in a horror film. You know, the shot obviously of the elevator and the blood coming from the elevator is,
and those terrifying twin baby girls that, yeah, are everywhere, and like you see them dead, then you see them alive. You're not really sure what you're looking at.
It's a creepy, unsettling film. I do think, actually, it's funny, me and a friend of mine were talking about this movie the other day. I do feel like, apart from one scene in this movie too, all the scares in it too pretty much hold up. And I think the only one that doesn't hold up, and you might agree with me on this, is the Here's Johnny bit. And it's just because
it's so memed, and like, yes, it's just so overused. And you know, I think the scare that gets me still gets me, because it just kind of lingers and like creeps up on you. Just how the whole scene feels.
It, yeah.
Like, bathtub.
Yeah. Oh, the bathtub. I 100% agree. The first time I saw it, I somehow did not know about that scene. Mm-hmm. So when I sat down and watched it, I was just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, so if you're looking to get a little scare, and you're looking at, like, thaw yourself out with some like adrenaline, I think The Shining is going to help you out with that.
Yeah, and another pick that I have that maybe would be something to watch after The Thing and The Shining, maybe laugh a little, have a better time.
Got to cool off.
That would be the Groundhog's Day, which is one of my favorite comedy films of all time.
It's so fucking funny.
It stars Bill Murray, who's a weatherman who goes to Punxsutawney every year to watch the groundhog come up, even though he does not want to be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds himself reliving the same day over and over in this kind of, like, nightmarish hellscape for himself.
Like, as a comedy, it's kind of dark.
Yeah, but, well, that's the thing that's great about it. It does have sort of deeper, sort of existentialist themes to it, you know, about morality and what it means to be a good person. And it also is just a really great romantic comedy at the same time.
Yeah, like, Andie MacDonald is in this movie. She's wonderful.
She's incredible in the movie, and their sense of chemistry is just, it's beautiful. It's really warm and touching. It's maybe, it's definitely top three Bill Murray for me.
It's my favorite Ned Ryerson movie out there. It's me, Ned Ryerson.
I mean, there's a reason why this movie has become sort of so iconic. It's kind of a movie I feel like anybody can watch and enjoy on some different level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just want to watch it as a straightforward comedy, you can get that out of it. You know, I know my mom, who's obsessed with rom-coms, she loves it just for that element. If you want to look sort of under the hood of it and explore some of the themes that it's exploring about, you know, as I said, morality, it's an incredibly deep and insightful film. And it's kind of also a great sort of moment that you can look back to is when Bill Murray started to transfer to being a slightly more serious actor, even if he's like a comic actor. Because, you know, it would only be a few years later than he was doing Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums.
Right. And, like, I feel like Groundhog's Day was pretty close to the What About Bob?
It was slightly after. Was it slightly after? 93.
Yeah, so like, looking at that style of movie, like, he was like in that in-betweener zone of just like comedy and drama, and it was pretty wonderful. Yeah. Anything else you want to say about Groundhog's
no,
Day?
No, I mean, it fucking rules. Go watch it.
Go watch Groundhog's Day. I definitely remember watching it laying on the floor of one of my bedrooms, and it's quite wonderful.
Is that the whole story?
That's the whole story. It's because, you know, you're laying around, it's cold outside.
what's your third pick?
My third pick is a musical from, I don't know how long ago it was, but it's very old. If you're familiar with musicals, you may know it. It's called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. It is just a comedy of just, but it's kind of chauvinistic at the same time, because you've got a main character who's a mountain man, and the only reason why he came to town was to find himself a wife. And he's singing a song that is titled Bless Her Beautiful Hide, and then he finds her and he tells her, hey, you should get married to me and come back to my place. She does, discovers it's not all it's cracked up to be, because there are six other brothers that live with this guy. He just happens to be the oldest one.
It's a lot of brothers.
Yeah, a lot of brothers. Seven brides, seven brothers. And you've got a moment in the movie where the brothers are like, our brother went down to town and got himself a wife, we're gonna do the same thing. And when they do this, they have to go through a valley, and in this valley is a bunch of snow, and they cause an avalanche, which means after they kidnap six other women and take them back to their
cabin. Are you sure this isn't a horror movie?
It is a horror film.
It sounds terrifying.
But it's a musical, so it's funny.
Oh, it's a musical horror film.
Yeah. After they've kidnapped all of these women, they cause an avalanche, and they can't. And the men of the town can't get up to the cabin until the spring thaw. So the snow is like one of the major elements that keeps them in like this kind of like they're trapped with these men.
Secluded area. Yeah. Yeah.
And luckily, the first woman who was kidnapped takes care of the entire situation and goes, "You're not going to mess with these women. I'm going to protect them from you and your stupid idiocy." It's very funny. It ends well. However, it's probably still kind of problematic. But you should watch it.
Yeah.
Just to see how stupid cinema could be.
Well, my pick is going to be something slightly more recent. And this, too, I believe this is on Amazon Prime. And this is Joe Carahan's The Gray. This is kind of a movie that, honestly, when it came to theaters, I had dismissed because of I looked at it as Liam Neeson versus a wolf. And I was like, if that's what this movie's going to be, I'm good. I don't need to see that. But then I kept seeing that, weirdly, by the end of the year, it was popping up on a lot of critics' like best of the year lists. And I was like, the movie where Liam Neeson fights a fucking wolf is on an end of the year list. And then I finally sat down and watched it, and honestly, it is one of those movies that was kind of completely sort of mismarketed, just to probably bring in a lot of the people who at the time were just liking the annual Liam Neeson action movie. You know, you had your Takens, your, I forget what the one on the train is. There's one where he goes to Russia. He just does a lot of stuff.
Liam Neeson. He'll find you.
He'll find you.
He'll find you and he'll do something to you.
But The Gray is actually a sort of survival drama. It's about a group of people on a plane. The plane crashes. I believe it's somewhere in the, like, high up in the north of Canada. And they're just completely surrounded by the elements. Obviously, they've sustained injuries and lost a lot of their goods and, you know, luggage and stuff, that they have to try to get by and survive in this tundra. And, it does, it's a lot more sort of, spare than you would have guessed. It's not too much, like a sort of pulpy genre film. It's very character driven. It's also very realistic. In terms of how they approach sort of the scenario that they find themselves in. It's not really at any point Liam Neeson versus the wolves. In fact, as a very mild spoiler, what I kind of find most frustrating about that trailer is the whole Liam Neeson versus the wolves is actually the final shot of the movie. So... it's like, that's a huge sort of misdirect.
Why do they do that?
And it's just actually one of, also, it's nice to see Liam Neeson in a movie that actually calls on him to act as well. Joel Edgerton's in it as well, who I really like, and he's fantastic there. They also play on the tensions between those and the crew and, you know, how their allegiances might shift, or there might be distrust among them, and it's a really compelling, just great thriller that I highly recommend if people haven't checked out.
Nice. Well, I think you've got a lot of things you can watch on your couch. It seems like a lot of these things are available through streaming or just digital VOD rentable kind of situations for you.
Yeah, but we're going to go to explore the tundra at the movies with The Call of the Wild.
What have you done now?
This is back.
Two. We needed two.
What? He's big.
Too big. He'll never make it.
He'll make it. What do you know? Ah. Okay, let's you meet the team. Beck, meet Spitz, your new boss. Stay out of his way. That's Dolly, Pike, Joe, Billy, Doug, Dave, and Solex. You are here. Welcome to the team.
Nick, I have something to tell you.
What's that, Brian?
This movie doesn't have a single real dog in it.
Really?
There's not a single real dog. and Call of the Wild.
Hmm.
So we're going to talk about Call of the Wild, and we're going to talk about these CGI dogs and Harrison Ford.
Let's have that conversation, Brian.
Right.
So what was your anticipation like going into Call of the Wild?
Okay, so the first time I saw the trailer, it was just like seeing the Aladdin trailer and seeing the Sonic the Hedgehog trailer, where like there was something happening on the screen that I just refused. I did not want this in my life. The CGI dog upset me so much in the trailer, mostly because of the scenes that they chose, like where like the dog having like human facial expressions, which were awful. But you know, I will say, going into the film, it was much different. How about you? What was your initial reaction?
So my initial reaction, I didn't have kind of like that sort of reaction of like abject horror to the trailer. I just kind of it feels like we get sort of these dog movies like two or three times a year now. We had a Dog's Journey or something last year.
Oh yeah,
where it was like a dog with three different owners. It feels like we get like one or two of these every year, and there was
one with the dog that was going through reincarnation.
Yep. Didn't bother to see any of those. I don't feel like I missed anything.
Is Driving in the Rain, does that have a dog in it too?
Yep, The Art of Driving in the Rain or some shit like that.
Yeah.
And I kind of was like, oh, it's another one of those. Except this time the dog's CG.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, fine, no interest. and so going into this, I believe we kind of were trying to decide what to see, and obviously, January and February can be a little barren for choices to see. And you had thrown this out there, and I was kind of like, yeah, you know what?
I just thought it was going to be a complete train wreck.
Yeah. And, I was not looking forward to it whatsoever. but I surprisingly had a nice time with the movie.
I did, too. I will, like, after watching it, I understand why all the dogs are CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's a very real reason for that, just from my storytelling standpoint, because there's no way you could get some of that stuff to happen that you saw on screen that was written in that Jack London book. Like if you tried, you'd probably get into a lot of trouble.
Yeah. You don't want, what is the movie called? A Dog's Tale.
Oh yeah.
You don't want that on your hands.
Nobody wants that anymore.
So, yeah, I mean, this is, as you say, it's an adaptation of a classic sort of adventure novel. I actually was kind of unaware of the novel before going in.
Yeah, I haven't read it either. A friend of mine mentioned that she was very interested in watching the movie because she had read the book and liked the book so much. And that was one of the reasons why I thought about watching this movie in general, was because she was so excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's also what brings me back to this idea of it being kind of like a classic story, because of it was kind of the similar thing. I was unaware of the novel, but I actually went to see this with my mom, and she told me she read it when she was little.
Mm-hmm.
So she kind of was very excited to see how they were going to adapt it. She really loved it when she was growing up. And I do think they did a really good job of just creating kind of a very sort of simple classic adventure story with this film.
It has a very large scale for sure. Like just the amount of travel that's happening through it, and the world is very large.
Yeah, and in a weird sort of way, because your character, main character, is a dog.
Right, I thought it was going to be Harrison Ford.
Yeah, and in all honesty, actually, Harrison Ford's probably only in about maybe a third of the movie.
He's right there in the tail end of that movie.
Yeah. God, fucking dog puns. I'm going to leave.
I'm sorry.
But in a weird sort of way, given that, you know, this isn't like a talking dog or anything, but it is, the dog is the central character. And it's weirdly kind of like a coming-of-age story for a dog.
Yeah.
Like, you're watching how he changes and evolves and grows throughout the years through the relationships he has with different people or the relationships he has with different dogs.
He's got a little bit of a Tom Sawyer thing going on.
Yeah. It's the other thing about that, though, I guess the other thing that really fascinates me about the movie is, you mentioned, you know, the CG in the movie, the fact that the dog does have, they do the sort of human actor, what's the term for that sort of CG?
I don't know.
I'm fucking blanking, but you know, you've seen Lord of the Rings, you know what Andy Serkis does.
Right.
It's that kind of vibe. And the thing about it that was really impressive to me, and what kind of kept me thinking throughout the movie, is I stopped at some point really thinking about this as something like Lord of the Rings, though, where you do have humans interacting with sort of something CG. And I almost started to think of it more as an animated movie that happens to have like one or two people in it.
Right. I had to do a very similar thing while watching, going like, I have to embrace this quality of this movie in order to really enjoy it. Like, it's not going to change. It's just how it's going to be. I give tons of credit to those animators, because those dogs act like dogs. Like, they look, at times it's like kind of, you kind of forget it. Like, each dog has a distinct personality, like dogs that you've met in real life. They just happen to have like a touch more personality than you're used to. Buck, especially, the main dog, has tons of personality, and he just, in droves, he's a very large dog. He's a very big presence on the screen. I think some of the cornier like reactions were the things I had the most problems with, and that was the stuff that showed up in the trailer. Okay. The rest of the time, it wasn't as bad. It was like, you know, giving actual dog disappointment eyes and going, oh, that's what a dog would definitely do.
Yeah. So I mean, I think my reaction almost was kind of slightly different to that, which this movie actually kind of started to blow my mind in a lot of ways when I started thinking of it as an animated movie, because it did make me start to think maybe about what the future of cinema and animation might look like. You know, we had the Lion King movie that came out last year. And the idea of it was creating something sort of similar to what The Call of the Wild's doing here.
Yeah.
It was a movie where the main characters were sort of CG animals. But the problem, and why I found myself absolutely detesting The Lion King, is that it had that problem of almost being too photorealistic. You know, when you watch The Lion King, the original animated version from the 90s, you have like that opening moment where Simba's born, and you see like Rafiki smiling and lifts him up, and all the animals sort of rise. And it's this really beautiful, warm, tender moment. And then you see the CG version, and they're so strict to sort of the laws of what animals can do, that you're literally just watching like a dead-eyed monkey stare at a baby lion with no emotion. And it's just like, how am I supposed to invest in this? And so I think with something like Call of the Wild, I definitely had the same issues you did when I saw the trailer, because I didn't understand the context. But then seeing kind of things like, I don't know, like Buck laugh or Buck smile and stuff, it's kind of a little exaggerated.
Yeah, it's just, it's like just a touch beyond realism, which is okay in a lot of places.
Yeah.
There's just like, there was definitely like a heavily edited portion of the trailer. It was like, you've been asleep for 3 days in my bed.
Right.
And then he like makes his face. That doesn't happen in the movie like that.
Yeah.
He doesn't make a face. I'm like, oh, that's not a joke in the movie. Thank
right. God. It's sort of, everything's, well, you know what's actually different is that scene is in the movie, but in the movie, it's not actually a joke.
Yeah.
Like, in the movie, that's actually a very dramatic, heavy scene.
Yeah, Bud goes through some shit.
Yeah, I mean, all the characters in this movie kind of do. And what's kind of weird about this is Harrison Ford is, like, at his age, almost famously, like, a curmudgeon. Like, he does not want to... He doesn't seem to care that much about cinema. He, like, has famously complained about being involved in the Indiana Jones and Star Wars movies in these days and not enjoying that process.
Yeah, I think he has stated in a particular interview that he enjoys like playing different styles of characters, and I think he resents the idea that like the Star Wars and Indiana Jones character overshadowed his other work.
Right.
Like The Witness, The Fugitive.
Yeah, yeah.
And all those things. Fanatic, I think, was another one.
Yeah, I mean, he's been in some great films, especially more dramatic roles throughout the late 80s and the 90s.
Yeah, there was a movie, I think, called Remembering Henry or something like that, where he goes through, like, he experiences insomnia. Not insomnia, amnesia.
Amnesia.
And it's honestly a wonderful movie. I don't know a lot of people that have ever seen it, but I'll low-key recommend that one.
Yeah. But what I was going to mention in regard to Call of the Wild is it is kind of, on the surface, sort of a silly kids movie, but it does feel like he's giving it his all in this.
Yeah, he's like, I was surprised to see the way he invested himself in this, because he's present throughout as a narrator, and then shows up like spot in spotty places throughout the movie.
But yeah, and almost has this weird sort of like Terrence Malick for kids narration for it, which is I kind of like. You know, like it gets kind of heady and a little existential in the narration, and talks about some of those themes about identity and fate and stuff like that. But it also just seems like he's having a good time too. Yeah. You know, like, I don't know, seeing what felt like a real sort of enjoyment and smile on his face during, like, the kayaking scene with Buck, like, it looked like he was just having a good time acting again, which I haven't seen in a while. So that was just, it was really a wonderful presence. And I also really like the rest of this cast here.
I was going to say, they're, like, Harrison Ford is only about half of the cast of humans that are, like, part of Buck's life.
You have, like, sort of this guy who's a French-Canadian. I forget what he does.
He is a postal worker.
That's right. He's a postal worker.
And he, but, like, his postal route is with a dog sled. And, like, there's just, like, this thing that they bring up that's, like, he's never on time because of the nature of his work. Like, but he always rides like he's gonna make it.
Yeah, and it's in like this very small town. It's actually a really cute, touching part of the movie, their relationship.
Yeah, it's honestly one of my favorite relationships in the movie. I think I like it more than where he ends up with Harrison Ford, because Perot, who is the male dog sled driver, is like attentive to like all the dog's needs. Like he's really like he's acting real hard, because not only is he's not acting with just one CGI dog, he's acting with like eight.
Yeah, and this is also kind of where like the cartoon element of it comes in too, because like his relationship with the dogs is kind of very comedic, where like they don't fully respect him, but he loves them.
Yeah, like he just like I get it. You're your own thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to get you to work with me.
And I think that's also where the other sort of animated aspect comes, is the movie does literally have, like, a mustache-trolling villain.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that. It kind of fully brought me into the just, like, cartoon aspect of the movie.
Yeah, he's almost Gaston.
Yes, he's very Gaston-esque. And, you know, I kind of wasn't surprised when the end credits rolled that the movie was directed by Chris Sanders, who did How to Train Your Dragon and Lilo and Stitch.
Okay.
So it's somebody whose background is primarily in animation. So it made sense also with the style of storytelling that it was very sort of classic cartoon animated family style storytelling. You know, even, like, the villain aspect felt very Lilo and Stitch to me.
Yeah. What's interesting is there are a couple. He doesn't encounter just one villain throughout. Mm-hmm. Like, there are just, they're antagonists throughout the movie, and each one is just, like, a different part of his life. First one introducing, like, the club as being kind of, like, the symbolic, like, I'm gonna hit you down and, like, put you in your place. So he kind of like grapples with this club and the man with the club. He's like always remembering that. And then you have the pack leader in the dog sled team, who is kind of like a dick.
Yeah.
It's like you don't really like this dog. He's a very pretty dog, but he's also a dick.
kind of a dick. Dick dog.
Dick dog. But then you have the guy who came from California or something. He's like, I'm going to find gold, but I have no understanding of how the outdoors works or how dogs work. You're supposed to feed them?
Yeah, just like blissfully unaware of everything in his new home. We also do get what felt like a very weird cameo from Karen Gillan in this, as one of the two people that, like, the couple that arrive in there.
Mm-hmm. She is very cartoony.
But also just for being in the movie for what feels like 3 minutes, yeah. 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, given that this is somebody who's in Avengers, Guardians of the Galaxy, Doctor Who, like, I was kind of surprised. I was like, is that her? And then I was like, holy shit, that's her. What is she doing in this? Very weird sort of cameo, but I mean, it's 3 minutes, so I'm not gonna complain about it. One thing I did notice in terms of credits, though, when they rolled, is this is the first movie under the new 20th Century Studios.
I was gonna say they changed the way that Fox was taken over by Disney.
Not happy. Not happy.
And they changed the logo up, and it looks. It hurts.
It's also just, like, kind of erasing part of cinema history. Yeah. Like, the Fox, for whatever, it just being, like, a lifeless corporation or whatever, this is a moniker that kind of is a huge part of cinema history. They were a studio that were responsible for creating some classic films, mm-hmm. Dating back decades and decades now. You know, if you're going to absolve the company, it seems to me like you should either release the films under your own banner or release them under the prior studios. Don't do this weird sort of like amalgamation where you're like literally kind of hacking away at another company's iconography and making it your own. It's really ugly to me. Disney. You've heard this before.
It was very disappointing to see. Like, it took me like a second to realize what was happening, and then like as I got to the movie, I was like, "Can I even enjoy this?"
Yeah,
I don't know if
and,
I can.
And you'll hear me probably on next week's episode. Me and Brian have a similar reaction to something else we saw Disney related.
You're gonna see a lot more of this, and I feel like we're gonna talk about it a lot more. So keep your ears open
in future apps. But so I mean, overall though, Call of the Wild, it was a surprisingly just nice, tender, warm adventure story. It felt very classical.
Yeah.
It made me very excited about the future of animation and where it can go.
Yeah, Disney definitely does a thing where they try to like blend a lot of stuff. This isn't like a necessarily new concept for them, because mm-hmm. Mary Poppins has a blend of live action and animation, and they kind of continue that forward. But this is just feels more tactile. The characters that are animated into it feel like they're right in there with them.
Yeah, like if it's almost like if the Lion King version that they did last year had been animated the way this had been, I probably would have enjoyed it a lot more. It still would have been wholly unnecessary. But, like, you need sort of those slightly exaggerated, cartoonish, more human expressions for these animals, because otherwise it's difficult for them to convey emotion, you know? Mm. Just pure, like, just animals can't fucking show the same range of emotions human can.
I mean, dogs can do it. Dogs can get pretty close. That there was an old dog in this movie, and I just want to mention this old dog. It's missing one eyeball, and it's like it's been on this team of sled dogs for so long, and it's like finally gets its chance to be like the lead dog, and it's like terrified.
Yeah.
But it definitely has the most dog reaction to getting a new harness put onto it. It's like moving away from the harness and like flipping over with his stomach in the air. This is probably the funniest moment in the movie for me.
Yeah, it works really well. The comedy of it works really well. And you know, again, it's trusting the animators to make something that's more artistic rather than photorealistic.
Yep.
I'm not gonna say it was like head over heels for this movie, but I had a really good time.
Yeah, this is a nice family flick. You know, as disappointed as I was in seeing the CGI dog in the trailer, I completely understand why it's there. I know why they're using it, and it makes the movie work. Take your kids to see it. Take your mom to see it. Take your girlfriend to see it. If you like dogs, go see the movie.
Yeah, I'll probably give it like maybe a 6 out of 10 for me. I really enjoyed it. But that's not the only Arctic movie we're going to talk about this week. We also got The Lodge coming up in just a bit.
This is the middle section of the podcast. We're going to hand things over to Nick to talk about a couple of things he wants to tell you about.
Yeah, folks, welcome to Nick's Picks. The Nick's Corner of Cinema. So I have been catching up on some films that we're not going to go too in-depth on the podcast this week, but I did want to mention, one of these being something you can definitely read about more on the website, coming up this week in our article about the horrors of Dumpuary.
Yeah, what's that website called? It's called cynicismfilm.com.
Yeah, I believe me and you run that together, Bride.
We do.
in that, one of those movies that we will be talking a little bit more about is Fantasy Island. This is a film adaptation of the famous TV show that ran, I believe it was in the 70s. I could be wrong about that.
Let's just shake our heads. Yes.
We'll say yes. This is a Blumhouse horror movie from the director who did the equally as enjoyable Truth or Dare.
Truth or Dare?
Yeah.
I dare you to tell me about this movie.
So I dare you to watch it. So if you had a good fucking time watching Truth or Dare, you're in luck. You have Fantasy Island now. This is a movie where people win a contest and go to an island where all their deepest fantasies can come to life, but they're more sinister than they could imagine.
It looks like a Hostile Light.
And
at least in the trailer, it looked
I almost
way.
Wish it was Hostile Light, because then it at least would have had like some fun gore or something to latch onto in this movie. This movie is painstakingly stupid. Everything in that happens in it does not make sense. For some reason, also, this has more plot than the fucking Irishman, but it's an hour and a half long. And for the first maybe 30 minutes of the movie, I was kind of like, this is bafflingly dumb, but I'm having a good time watching it. Like, it was kind of that so stupid it's funny type deal.
Okay.
It also just had weird moments where it suddenly just felt like a bad early 2000s comedy. Like, there's a very kind of like dude where's my car element to this movie. Like, and the relationships between characters in it.
We're going to Fantasy Island, dude.
That's the number of times you hear the words bro and like just shots of like a girl in a bikini and then like people like fist bumping. Like, that's the entire opening 30 minutes.
Are there influencers going to Fantasy Island like Firefest?
Ooh, I feel like there's wannabe influencers. You have a lot of people who so badly want, like, are worried about their gram, but it was clearly written by like a 60-year-old man who does not understand what Instagram is.
Instagram.
And then it takes a turn after pretty much what you see in the trailer, where everything you see in the trailer is the first 30 minutes of this movie. Yeah. Yeah. Brian's looking at me confused and perplexed right now, and that's the correct
part of that was the end of the movie.
That was the correct response. because from there, it goes to some weird places where Michael Rooker plays like this weird machete wielding forest weirdo who helps guide them and try to get them off this island.
Oh man,
he's having a good time.
It's a little bit like Jumanji.
A little bit like Indiana Jones, a little bit like The Runes, a little bit like my worst fucking nightmare inside a movie theater. I watched this as part of a double feature before The Lodge, and I did not realize it was going to be 2 hours. And at one point, and thankfully, the movie's kind of just about made it so that I could go from one theater to the other, But I seriously considered walking out of the last half hour because I was like, I'm not going to miss anything. I swear to God I won't miss anything. Except, you know, time I could have to myself and my sanity. Yeah, don't watch this unless you're a masochist. It's not good. It's not a fun movie. It's really bad.
And this movie is a part of a piece that you're working on that includes other movies of similar nature at the beginning of 2020.
Yeah, so I mean, as I said, we have the piece coming up on cynicism.com about the horrors of Dumpuary. And if you don't know what the term Dumpuary, that's essentially a term coined by Grantland in the early 2010s. And it refers to these movies that essentially sit on studio shelves for sometimes a year, sometimes 2 years, where studios don't know what to do with them. They produced them a while ago. They don't feel confident in them. So they end up dumping them during what are considered the lightest times of the box office, which are January and February.
Fuck you, it's January.
Hence, Dumpuary. And this feels like a movie that somebody did not want to release. Yikes.
That's disappointing, Nick.
Yeah, but, I mean, the thing is...
Why do you think they do that? Like, why is it so slow at the beginning of the year? I feel like sometimes when it's an indie release, it tends to be a lot stronger than when it comes from, like, a major...
I think what it simply is a lot of times with major studios, you have them funding a lot of different projects. And with major studios, when you have a slate that's probably considerably bigger than something that an indie studio is putting out every year, you have a lot more properties to sort of manage. And you're also looking at the slate as it's coming out to try to see when these movies could do best. You're trying to think when they could compete against other films that other studios are releasing. Like, you would not be releasing Fantasy Island the same week as Joker. You knew it would have gotten buried. So they try to find somewhere, and a lot of times they're just like, I don't see anywhere we can put this where it'll do well. And as a result, the January and February seasons exist in a weird place where Oscar season has just ended. The spring and summer movie season has not begun yet. People are, because of a lot of times just simply the weather in the northern states, they're staying home more. They're staying inside. They don't go to the movies as often. Even with the sort of holiday movie slate, a lot of times that just does better because of that. It's the holidays. People are going to the movies with their families. People are off for Thanksgiving or Christmas breaks. With this, people are more home. So they know they're not going to have as many people going to the movies. And as kind of a total fucking gamble, they just put the movies out during those seasons and hope that maybe they'll roll the dice and it'll end up being kind of a surprise hit.
Yeah. I feel like there's been a couple of times where I've gone out and seen something that I kind of enjoyed and had a good time with. But yeah, for the most part, that's the feel I get in the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And you have another movie, yeah?
Yeah, so the other movie, in a weird way, and I don't want this to sound insulting, in a weird way, this is another movie that could be categorized as part of the Dumpuary season in a very different way. And this is essentially movies that studios would have released for Oscar season, but they just didn't get that Oscar push that they would have wanted. They didn't get the nomination. So they ended up holding off on them a little while. So this is a movie called Incitement, and this was Israel's submission for Best Foreign Film, or now Best International Film at the Oscars. It didn't get a nomination, so they kind of sat on it for a while. But this is directed by Yaron Zilberman, who actually did a English language movie a couple years ago that was pretty good, called A Late Quartet, and it was sort of about an aging sort of classical quartet of players. It was one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's last roles. And it was a very good little drama. This is more a sort of white knuckle thriller. It's kind of about a man in his sort of early 20s who was the person who assassinated the Prime Minister of Israel. in 1995. I'm probably butchering his name, but it's Yitzhak Rabin. And it's kind of about the process of how he becomes radicalized over the course of his early 20s. And the sort of political and religious groups he finds himself absolved into, the relationships that he has with friends that kind of get torn apart by this. But it also feels really timely because of how partisan things have gotten in this country. And it is very much, it feels like the Israeli version of being red-pilled. Like, he literally finds himself slowly moving to this fringe white right-wing organization. And what's really chilling about it, kind of at the end, is, you know, obviously his successor was Netanyahu, who's still in power. And at no point had Netanyahu ever kind of criticized the assassination or ever mentioned it, ever given his condolences. So it's kind of this portrait of how a right-wing leader can kind of sort of whip up a fervor and a hatred towards people on the other partisan side and not have to deal with any of the repercussions of the violence that comes from it. Which, again, in America right now feels scarily timely. But it is a very good, very disturbing character piece. And I don't know if it's playing everywhere. I know here in Buffalo it is playing right now. And yeah, I highly recommend checking it out. It's not a feel-good movie, but it's definitely something I found really insightful.
Yeah, it definitely sounds heavy as fuck. Yeah, I'll probably have to check it out since it's in Buffalo. So that was Nick's picks. He got you off to a good start in the beginning of the episode with some good picks there, and we got some other picks here. Maybe you don't want to see Fantasy Island, but you might want to check out the other one. All right, so we're going to move forward and hit you with some The Lodge.
We're leaving. I need my pills, and we're just going to walk to the nearest town and call your dad, and then he's going to come pick us up. So you have to pack your things.
What are you talking about? We can't leave.
It's not up for discussion.
Look outside, Grace. That's crazy. We don't even have our jackets. We're not going.
I'll go alone.
You won't make it. Grace.
Grace.
Don't go.
So our Arctic marathon continues, and this time we're bundling up and getting in the lodge, Brian.
Oh, it's so cold.
It's
I want to go outside, but it's too cold.
It's too chilly, so just bundle up and stay in this lodge with us. So the film we're talking about next, this is a horror film starring Riley Keough. It comes to us from the Swedish team behind 2014's Good Night, Mommy. What was your sort of anticipation like going into this one?
After seeing the initial trailer and understanding that there was some cult connection stuff to it, I was pretty excited. I had pretty moderate expectations for this movie. I thought it was going to be pretty good. The trailer looked scary, had like the right kind of feel. That one of the child actors was from the It
movies. Jaden Martell.
Yeah, and he's also in
Knives Out
as that Nazi kid. Yeah. So like he's showing up. So I thought, maybe he'll be
good at being a little shit.
Oh, he's so good at being a little shit.
Yeah, so I was pretty excited for this one. I'm a big fan of the 2014 movie Good Night, Mommy, which is a film that is immensely dark, super disturbing, and has some of like the gnarliest, at least has one of the gnarliest scenes I've seen in recent horror. Yeah, just very, very disturbing. So I was very excited to see what they were going to do next. I'm a big fan of Riley Keough. I think she's probably one of the best young actresses working right now. But she's almost always in supporting roles in films like American Honey, Under the Silver Lake. And it's nice to sort of see her in a more, take more center stage. So I was really excited to see what she was going to do given that opportunity. And yeah, I really liked this movie.
It's okay.
So for me, I kind of found this to be a very, first of all, so very similarly to Goodnight Mommy. I found the film immensely dark and pretty disturbing. They do have a very sort of nihilistic tone to their films. This isn't one with a ton of humor or a ton of joy.
I wouldn't say there's any humor or joy in it at all.
Things just get progressively bleaker.
It starts off pretty heavy.
Starts out bleak and just keeps getting darker.
Bleaker and bleaker.
And it goes to some really sort of dark places psychologically and emotionally too, and in terms of the kind of torment unleashed in this film isn't really as... there's definitely physical moments, but it's more psychological, and I found it profoundly disturbing. Riley Keough just fucking kills it in this movie. I think she's incredible. I really hope that somebody out there, producers, are watching this and give her more sort of lead roles, because I think she's just an absolutely incredible actress. The fact that she sort of plays such a kind of confounding character, because this character she's playing at is essentially someone who grew up in a religious cult that was kind of like a Heaven's Gate type thing.
It didn't seem like a Heaven's Gate thing. It seemed more, it was very much a Christian based. I didn't see anything relative to Heaven's Gate, which is more alien.
I just mean in terms of like
they all died. Oh, it's a suicide cult.
Yeah. Exactly. In terms of they all died.
Yeah.
Which is an immensely disturbing way to grow up.
Yeah, it's fucked up.
And so she's kind of dealing with the PTSD of that, as well as she is sort of the girlfriend to the father of these two children, mm-hmm. who just lost their mother, who killed herself as well. And immensely heavy way to start the film. But on top of it, she's carrying all this baggage, both from her past and from this role she's having to play in this family. And it's kind of, it's so kind of painful to watch, because there is such a kind of empathy and sweetness that she tries to bring and tries to sort of share with these kids, who understandably are not receiving it because of this really dumb father.
I'm going to say that, like, yes, I agree this movie is painful to watch, but for different reasons. I think the acting is superb. Like, the actors, they all do a wonderful job with what they're trying to do. However, it just seems like this movie is all kinds of all over the place. From a cinematic point of view, from a writing point of view, it also, like, borrows super heavily from films that have only very recently come out, especially with imagery and things that they're trying to do. There's literally, like, almost duplications of shots from the movie Hereditary.
Yeah, so it's funny you mention that, because I actually did, when I was watching the movie, I was like, I wonder if they were influenced by Hereditary, or even thought, like, maybe that's an homage. And then I was very surprised to learn this movie actually was in production before Hereditary.
Okay.
So it might have just been something that was, like, in the ether, people like creepy dollhouses.
Creepy dollhouses. This dollhouse is the stupidest thing in this whole movie.
Oh, I really like the dollhouse.
It's just, like, it's just kind of like they put the dollhouse in there to kind of do as, like, a... I'm not going to say what it is, because, like, it's, like...
It would spoil
some stuff. So it's just like you see it happening and then it just kind of like inserts itself in like really odd ways. It didn't really work for me. And it kind of messed the movie up. I think for me, if you had taken the dollhouse stuff out, it would have been a little bit more impactful.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I found that stuff kind of very eerie.
I mean, I like that doll.
The doll. Sort of has a doll that sort of represents her mom.
Yeah, she's carrying around a doll that like looks like her mother. And I like the use of that, like, because it's very messed up.
Yeah. I mean, the movie does essentially what happens in it is, you know, we've explained the family dynamic and then how dumb this fucking father is, where he essentially leaves the girlfriend to bond with his kids while he goes back to work.
He's not a very good listener.
No,
many times he is told, I don't want to do this. And then like, you know, just kind of having an understanding of what his girlfriend's past was like and seeing what his kids are going through are not really understand. Like,
he doesn't seem to understand empathy.
He's smarter than that. And like, I kind of refuse to believe that he is that oblivious.
I'm going to say, as a child of divorce, I disagree. I think a lot of parents are kind of a bit oblivious to what their kids are going through, especially when you bring new people into the house. I'm not saying that was necessarily my past, but I did have experiences similar to that. Mm-hmm. I do think there is a certain breed of probably guys who are oh so eager to move on, and because they have personally, they think their children are too. But I mean, it really sets up mostly what becomes sort of a chamber drama, which is the relationship between these two kids and this girlfriend, and neither of them really trust each other. There's sort of an attempt to engage and form a relationship, and at times it seems like there's breakthroughs. At other times it's so cold and distant that you know, it plays with the same theme of just being stuck in this one place with nobody to connect to emotionally. And they're both two people sort of processing trauma with the kids. It's sort of the weight of their, you know, the loss of their mother. And with the girlfriend, it's sort of this trauma from the religious cult and sort of the ideas they burned into her.
Yeah, you definitely got like this attachment that the kids are trying to like break free from, but also they're putting a lot of blame on people where blame doesn't belong.
Right, which is, it feels like a very kid thing to do.
Yeah.
But it's funny, speaking about homages and sort of influence, I do feel like this movie does pay kind of very deliberate homage to the two movies we mentioned earlier in the episode. Since they are essentially stuck in the Arctic in this cabin, mm-hmm. Very similar to The Thing and The Shining in terms of the location. And we do, as I mentioned, see a scene where they literally watch The Thing on TV.
Yeah, I think Sleepaway Camp shows up on there too. Like, yeah. The very end of the movie shows up.
And some very deliberate homages to The Shining. The apartment number that the dad lives in is room 223. The dog is named Grady.
Let's just say I love Grady. And Grady, I love you, Grady.
I
love this dog. he's such a cutie.
But the movie does get... I would say I'm not going to disagree with you in places where I'll say that I do believe it's maybe a little overridden. I don't think that it may be... I feel like it's definitely a movie that takes some turns. I don't want to get quite into what those turns are.
Yeah.
And I actually like all the choices that it makes. I just don't feel like they were always conveyed as clearly as they could have been.
Yeah, it just seems like a lot of the really big reveal stuff was very... It was almost either too subtle or didn't have as much of an impact as it should have.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of one of the big problems that I have with it, because like it really should have punched you in the face.
I mean, I will say for one of the turns the movie takes, I did have a sort of underwhelmed reaction. For A Turn It Takes Later, I definitely had a moment where I was saying out loud, holy shit. So it definitely, the later one really got to me. And it comes right back to the theme that these filmmakers think kids are really fucking scary.
Yeah, kids are scary.
And stupid. Yeah, that too. And I do like sort of the, again, the claustrophobia of this. There's also some degrees of surrealism that it takes in the midsection of this film. Mm-hmm. Essentially regarding, when our primary character does venture out a little bit outside of the lodge. And I found that really cool visually. I found it super interesting. I also just was really scared during the movie. I do admittedly scare easy in horror movies.
I do too, but I'm going to say I was not scared at all watching this movie.
Yeah, I actually, full disclosure, confession, I had planned to see this movie earlier in the day, and I went in and the theater was empty, and I lasted a half hour and then left and then came back to a later showing when people were in it.
Oh, man.
I was like, nope, can't do it. I was too scared.
I went with my partner and like we were the only ones in the theater, which kind of allowed us to like talk a little bit during the movie, which you don't get the opportunity to do very often, but it was a unique experience.
Yeah. So I think we have pretty different takes on the movie.
I'll say the acting is good. I think that like maybe there's just a little, it just needed a little extra polish on there to be a better movie.
Mm-hmm.
There is some imagery in there that's pretty powerful and really good. There's a structure in the movie that is very impressive to see. I don't know if they built that or if they found it.
I also just love that painting.
Yeah, there's a painting of basically what looks to be like a holy woman, and it's creepy.
It's really creepy.
And it's dark and creepy.
I like this movie, I think, a good bit. I'm not going to say, like, an incredible bit more than you did, but I did like it a good bit more. I found it really scary. I do agree that I think its writing isn't as clear as it should be. I do think it's over-plotted a little. And I do think that we maybe needed another scene or something in the last third of the movie to tie the motivation for why characters would do certain things that they do. It almost felt like there needed to be a little push more to understand why they'd make that choice. But if you try to take this movie kind of just as an experience, as just a straight horror movie, and don't analyze it too deeply, I mean, as an exploration of religion, I understand what it's doing in its subtext, but I don't think it's exploring it in any profoundly meaningful way.
I agree with that sentiment, because it almost feels like they introduce it mostly as a mechanic and less as a tool to create more depth to the movie.
Yeah. I understand what they were trying to do. I don't know they explored it as thoroughly as they could have. But I had a lot of, I don't want to say fun, because it's very bleak. but I did really enjoy it. It did creep me out. And after what's been two really rough months of horror movies, it feels like the beginning of films starting to turn around this year for me. And I'm sure you'll hear about movies that both me and Brian probably like more coming up in future episodes. So,
sounds like you like that movie. So if you're looking for something to watch and you're interested in like religious cult stuff, maybe check out The Lodge.
Yeah.
Just be aware that it's not a perfect movie, but you might like it. Up next week, we're going to be seeing two other movies. We're gonna see what is it? Half Invisible Dad from Disney's Pixar.
With Onward. Do you want to re-record that bit?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Don't you tell me what to do.
Alright, I'll give you one more chance for the joke. You gotta hear it, Brian. Let's go. We got
next week we're gonna be watching Half Invisible Dad and Fully Invisible Husband.
With Disney's Onward and The Invisible Man.
Disney didn't make The Invisible Man.
Did I say Disney's Invisible Man?
You said Disney's Onward and The Invisible Man. Oh, fuck. It's okay. Guys, we're trying real hard.
But that's all for this week. We'll see you next week at the movies.